This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time. Turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
Good morning, everybody. 7 o'clock hour, Sports Radio 610. In for Sean Pendergast this morning. I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. We've got you till 8 o'clock this morning before we turn things over to Texans Radio. In between now and then, if you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610, 572-4610. You can text in the 5-Hour Energy fan line. 5-Hour Energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610 and football super fans. We'll get to a little Texans here. I asked the question, are you ready to burn this situation, or is it actually just beginning? I think both can be true, Seth, but that's why I'm a little bit intrigued about the D'Amico Ryan's press conference coming up later today. He'll address the media at 12:15.
I'm guessing a lot of our listeners have gone through this too. You feel like, all right, yeah, I'm done with the Azeez Alshire stuff. That's enough. But then something comes across your social media timeline, or some idiot at the convenience store says something that annoys you, and you're right back in it. Right back in it. And I know myself. I'm going to be baited back into this at some point. The most encouraging thing, I think, after the initial fervor was that I've seen so many offensive players and former offensive players kind of come around, if not in defense of Azeez Alshire, at least to say, all right, let's back off a little bit and not be painting this guy like he's the most evil person who's walked the earth this century. Mm-hmm. So like Mark Schlereth, former offensive lineman, old school guy, but an offensive lineman. This is Mark Schlereth on Fox talking about how basically disingenuous he thinks some other former players and current players are being.
I feel like it's my responsibility to at least try to educate you from a player's perspective on how split seconds those are. But let me just say this. The thing that irritated me and has irritated me more than the general population that doesn't understand how hard that is and the dilemma you put the defensive players in is former players and current players not standing up and being honest. That's what bothers me because it's impossible.
And I think that's where we've seen a lot of offensive players and quarterbacks. I mean, I think more take the slide rule on than they have any interest in painting out Azeez Alshire to be a monster. And I guess that's where I understand why Caserio was so adamant about that letter, because it might have felt to some people, and I know it felt to a lot of people, like Caserio was missing the point or trying to sidestep the issue.
Yeah.
I think the way that letter from the NFL read and the way it was framed, they basically did make it sound like he was just completely out of control and he didn't give a damn about anything or anybody. Frankly, I thought it painted him out to be like a headhunter, which even on that play itself, I didn't think if he had wanted to hit Trevor Lawrence in the head, he totally could have hit him in the head.
Yeah.
That part of it, I think that'll die down over time. I don't think come February or March, people around the league are going to be framing this like, oh yeah, Azeez Alshire is the new Vontaze Burfict or something like that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, because how far the Texans go and remain a part of the conversation could have a little bit to do with that, but in regards to that letter alone, the letter in large part, the way it read to me and the way that Caserio, I think, took it, it was much more about what happened after the hit. The hit's the one thing. It's just everything that transpired after. And if we're being real about it, we're not spending a week on this thing if it's just a hit. We're spending a week on it because it's the hit. Then there's two fights afterwards, and we're looking at a guy who, you know, came unhinged a little bit, but had an entire football team like trample him and go after him initially. And so that's really the whole thing. And it sparks, you know, the conversation. Well, it shouldn't, but it did, you know, about a guy's religious beliefs and political beliefs. And then it becomes personal for a lot of people. And that's where we went.
Yeah, and Evan Engram was fined this weekend for his, I think it was a $9,000 fine.
Whopping $9,000. You talk about per diems, huh?
yeah. Which, and like, that's where I feel like there's a bit of hypocrisy from the league in that they supposedly care about player safety regardless, and a hit in retribution is not any different than a hit on a quarterback at full speed, where Evan Engram, no matter what his motivation was or anything else like that, I mean, he flat out hit a guy from behind who was completely and 100% totally defenseless.
Yeah.
It was several seconds after the play. I do feel there's a little, if what you're actually concerned about is player safety, that's a pretty damn egregious violation. And if the melee afterwards was part of what you're finding Aziz Alshire for, I'm surprised that no other Jaguars are fined or treated harshly for that. That's where it still feels to me like a whole lot of grandstanding by the league.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact that Trevor Lawrence is a quarterback, that's a bit, the guys who are literal headhunters who are actually getting suspended and fined for helmet to helmet contact or targeting the head, like, those hits are much, much worse in terms of the actual contact. The Neville Hewitt's hit last year that got him suspended was a helmet-to-helmet blow. That's the part where I get they have to protect their moneymakers, but don't try to paint Aziz Alshire out like he is a Vontaze Burfict or any of these other guys that were notorious headhunters.
No, I agree with you. I mean, to me, if you're going to, you know, hand out punishments like the NFL did, by the way, it was like just over $11,000 for Evan Engram on the fine. But, you know, what about Jerrion Jones? Yeah, I'm sure if you went and reviewed film, you'd find a couple of other Jacksonville Jaguar players, because it was on their sideline, that you could have found at fault for failing to extinguish, you know, the situation, or exacerbating things because of their actions. And if again, you're talking about player safety, if you're talking about the integrity of the league, if you're worried about all of those things and just moving on and getting back to playing football as quickly as you possibly can after a hit like that, then you have to be able to punish the guys that disallowed you from doing so. And there were far more many Jacksonville Jaguars that continued to fan the flames and overreact, or just react. I won't say overreact, because I get it about protecting your player, especially a quarterback. I just felt like the NFL, again, mishandled the situation, and now you have to deal with the consequences and move on.
Well, the other big thing about the aftermath was you had all these noble and virtuous souls standing up and saying, well, if Trevor Lawrence is going to miss four games because of a concussion, then Aziz Alshire should be out for four games.
Yeah.
And
they
were almost reciting it like it was fact that he had been put on the IR, that Lawrence had been put on the IR because of the concussion.
Yeah.
Doug Peterson came out on Friday and flat out said, no, it was not the concussion that put him on IR. It was the shoulder, and that he had to have shoulder surgery. And a few people dialed it back. Some didn't bother addressing it at all. But Aziz Alshire didn't put Trevor Lawrence out for the season. I'm going to tell you another thing. This is something to monitor for a divisional opponent. I feel like Doug Peterson has maybe been one of the most level-headed guys in how he's responded to all this. This is a guy, you got to remember, Doug Peterson is a guy that played with Brett Favre. And I feel like Brett Favre, if he had gotten that hit, you know, back in the day where he wouldn't have had to enter the concussion protocol, he would have taken a shot of whiskey on the sideline and been back out there. It's just two different eras. But the thing with Trevor Lawrence is, it's every single year there are these minor injuries, and I include a separated shoulder in your non-throwing arm as a minor injury for a quarterback. Last year, CJ Stroud played through a separated shoulder all season long as a rookie. It's pain tolerance. And Trevor Lawrence has had so many minor injuries either affect his play or keep him out of games that I don't frankly think that he has the constitution of a good NFL quarterback, because that's part of the job in the NFL. As protected as quarterbacks are, they still take a lot of hits, and they're unprotected a large majority of the time, and they are injured all the time. So that, like, playing as badly as he did with a separated shoulder and his non-throwing arm,
yeah,
I honestly just don't get that. Sean, I know so many, like myself included, but I know so many defensive linemen that have played with separated shoulders. And then at the end of the season, sometimes the remedy is you just snip off your clavicle. If it's that badly separated, it's like you snip off the tip of the clavicle. So for a quarterback to go on IR because of that, or to be playing poorly for it, I just have no sympathy for him. It's not what tough NFL quarterbacks do.
Yeah, well, it's a different era. And you mentioned Doug Peterson.
But it's not a different era when it comes to stuff like that. The good quarterbacks are still playing through that stuff. I don't think Trevor Lawrence is a good quarterback specifically because of that.
Well, okay, yeah, I understand what you're saying now. You're right, on the surface, 100%. I'm talking about like the perception for a lot of people. That's a convenient excuse for a lot of people, and Jacksonville Jaguar fan as well. It's like, well, hey, look, our guy was hurt. Yeah, but it was his non-throwing shoulder, okay? And then I had the question, you know, initially too. It's, okay, if that hit doesn't happen, if the Jags go ahead and, you know, they get the brakes blown off of them or whatever, they lose that game, when do the Jags make the call of, you know, sitting Trevor Lawrence for the rest of the season anyway? Because... Right. Okay, you're going to miss, at least from what, every hit's different, but we've had multiple situations here over the last couple of years where the Texans have suffered concussions. They've missed not 1 week, but 2 weeks, usually. In some cases, I think it's been 3 weeks, depending on the player. Well, Trevor Lawrence, maybe he misses 2 weeks. You still got 2 weeks left to go in the season. They decided, well, the shoulder, let's go ahead and get the concussion out of the way and deal with the shoulder, and we'll press the reset button and hope for better next year.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty obvious. If Trevor Lawrence had continued to play the way he was playing, they probably would have done this with or without a head injury, because he was completely ineffective.
Yeah.
You saw that. Mac Jones came out and was way better, and now facing soft coverages because the Texans had a healthy lead, but still, he looked better even with his bad throws initially than some of the stuff Trevor Lawrence was doing. Trevor Lawrence was trying to make throws that he had no business trying to make, like throwing it at a double coverage into tight windows. He was lucky he only had one interception up to that point in the game. He easily could have had three in the first half alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they probably, there's a good chance they would have shut him down. I know a lot of the criticism has been, why was he out there anyway looking as bad as he did? Nobody else was watching that game outside of Jacksonville or Houston.
Yeah.
Because why bother? Like, you look at the coverage map of the markets that had that game, and it was pretty much Houston and Jacksonville and not many others.
Well, unfortunately, it's been that case. Yeah, AFC South showdowns in recent years. Well,
oh, yeah, yeah. No, they're relatively mute affairs. You guys... You got three. I got jealous watching the Steelers and the Browns yesterday because it made me miss the old AFC Central.
Oh,
like, oh yeah. Man. Yeah, we used to be a part of the AFC Central, you know, like back when it was the Oilers, and it just, you had all these. And then even when the Jaguars were added to the mix, they were very good at the beginning. While it was still the AFC Central, the Jaguars were a team to be contended with. And now, not so much.
Real quick, you mentioned Doug Peterson. I'm sure you saw his comments responding to D'Amico's, stance on the hit last week. I was impressed immediately by Peterson's, you know, attitude and kind of level of emotion. You said, you know, I think level-headed was the term that you used.
Yeah.
You said, quote, "I would say that if it happened to their quarterback, I think the reaction would have been the same, quite frankly. But again, look, this was 3 days ago, and we're on to Tennessee, obviously, and focused on that. But I do think the reaction is a natural thing for any player, any team to feel." That's 3 days after the fact, those comments.
Yeah.
They were very similar to his reaction minutes after the game had concluded. Like, the guy, when I think a lot of Jacksonville fans are, you know, expecting to hear the same thing from Doug Peterson from their behalf that we heard from D'Amico Ryans on the Texans' behalf, they didn't get. And I think that's what kind of miffed a lot of Jacksonville Jaguar, you know, sports talk show hosts and fans. It's like, you know, what are we doing here? Like, where's the reaction here? Where's the proper response? Like, everybody's high and, you know, very high emotion after the hit, after the game. And you have Doug Peterson very calm, level-headed, and, you know, saying, as a former quarterback himself, yeah, I kind of get it. You know, it's the shoe was on the other foot, and that's not what they were ready to hear.
It's one I will say that's one thing that D'Amico's done a couple times this year with Alshire, where I feel, you know, the couple things that Caserio and D'Amico did in their defense of Alshire that didn't quite ring true. And I think with D'Amico, twice now with Alshire, he's criticized the other team's sideline for the way they were handling things or anything.
Yeah.
But Aziz Alshire is the guy that finds himself in the middle of that. Because after the Bears game, D'Amico criticized the sideline management of non-uniformed personnel. And likewise, he criticized the Jaguars after. If there was no response from any Jaguars player, Jaguars fans would have been irate. We've done this ourselves. It was in the Green Bay game when CJ was getting roughed up on the sideline and there was nobody from the Texans over there to support him or bail him out or scrap it up. You know, last year when D'Amico got hit by that Broncos linebacker and four offensive linemen rushed up to help CJ, people very much noticed that Laremy Tunsil was just chilling at the line of scrimmage and not doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the fans want to see a response like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I get that part of it. And that's where I don't criticize Evan Engram for having the response he did. I criticize the league for not coming down harder on him and just fining him $9,000. If they're pointing to the melee, the league is pointing to the melee as one of the worst possible things that could have happened. All right, well, the way you guys write the rules and the way you enforce them is that Evan Engram is just as responsible for the melee as Aziz Alshire himself. That part of it bothers me.
He said
the in terms of other offensive players, I thought this one was interesting just because it's Equanimeous St. Brown and Amon-Ra St. Brown, brothers who are both wide receivers, current players in the league. Mm-hmm. This is Equanimeous St. Brown talking to his brother, Amon-Ra St. Brown, about how he feels about the Alshire hit.
What are your initial thoughts? One, it wasn't on purpose. I'm sure he's just playing hard. But usually they let up. You could slide earlier. Like, you know, I feel like
trying to get the extra yards.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Like, he's trying to stop you from getting the first down. You're trying to get the extra yards. Like, at that point, stay up. Like, some quarterbacks don't always slide. Like Josh Allen won't slide probably, you know? Sometimes sliding is more dangerous than not sliding, I feel like. If I was a quarterback, I would never slide, but, like, I'd slide hella early or not at all.
And then Amon-Ra St. Brown sounded a little bit more on the fence, except that also basically just he said, yeah, the sliding is – the quarterback takes – some responsibility when you slide. And I think that's the long term implications of this is that I think they probably are going to tweak the slide rule somewhat or make it some kind of emphasis in the offseason. But I've actually been kind of pleasantly surprised by how many offensive players, both current and retired, have just come out and said, yeah, look, the targeting and everything, it all makes sense. We get it. But you got to acknowledge on some level and in some situations that it ain't easy.
Yeah.
And it's not always a matter of, okay, this guy's willfully trying to injure somebody who's unprotected. That's why it bothers me that the quarterback is being afforded so much extra attention in this one, because the wide receivers, when they get hit and targeted, they're genuinely defenseless. They have no say or control in the matter. They're catching the ball right as it's thrown. They are stretched out and laid out. And a lot of times in a lot of those hits, you can see now that we've got a decade of kind of monitoring this stuff, there's times where you can tell, all right, the defensive back totally could have avoided that hit.
Like, sure,
we know.
Sure.
We used to say at the beginning of it all, we used to say, nah, there's no way. Now we know. But with the quarterback slides, I think it's just too much of a gray area still.
It's very gray. I mean, you know, the difference between a quarterback or just any ball carrier. Just look at it from this. If you already have the football and you're making football moves, you're concerned about one thing, avoiding a hit. Try not to get tackled. If you're concentrating, rather, as a pass catcher on trying to catch a football and avoid a hit and trying to make a football move, like all of these things going on in milliseconds time. That's what makes you more susceptible as a defenseless player in that regard. And so I think ultimately it's not that difficult to figure a remedy out, but it is very difficult when you're on the other side of the ball as a defender to make a split second decision. These are things that are always going to be a part of the game as an operating in a gray area, because it's just about instinct and reaction, and you cannot predict nor expect what another player is seeing or say that they should be doing all of the time.
Right, when that quarterback is making that conscious, or yeah. not conscious in the, you know, but he's making that decision to try to go for extra yardage, and he's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Absolutely.
Trying to get the first down, but also, you know, protect himself. I wish one thing Tom Brady would say, because Tom Brady has come out and basically said, yeah, it's really hard, and the quarterback has to take responsibility.
Yeah.
I wish he would bring up that, I wish he would just say, this is why I kicked Ed Reed in the junk that time. You guys remember? Remember? Yes. Yeah, I slid, but I'm also like, I'm really trying to protect myself. And going in spikes high, for those of you that don't remember or are too young to have seen it, Tom Brady slid, but very much had his cleats in the air, and he connected with Ed Reed's groin back before Ed Reed was an awful Texan
player. Ty Cobb that thing, man. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ty Cobbed it. Just say that, Tom. Say just like, this is why I kicked Ed Reed in the nargs.
He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. We'll find out over the course of the week and the coming weeks just how much the Texans have decided to put this ordeal, the Azeez Al-Shaair ordeal, in the rearview mirror. Because I think there is an element where this team does kind of take on the villain role. I know that was very personal to Azeez, but I think the Texans can kind of accept that sort of a role from a football perspective as well. It'll be interesting to see what kind of nasty, because I go back to the conversation you and I had last year around this time where it was in and around the Denzel Perryman, you know, hit where he suffered punishment by the NFL. And that was a guy when the Texans brought him in where I was like, hey, you know what? Yeah, they got themselves a little thumper. They got themselves a little bit of nasty. Now let's see it put into action. Well, they did. And you see it kind of 2.0 this year. I wanted the Texans, and I think D'Amico wanted his defense to be that team with that moniker, not necessarily dirty by any stretch, at least one that's going to, you know, cost your team games and players games, but instill a little bit of fear and trepidation into the opposition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he wants the opponent to feel it the next day.
Yeah.
And if you look at a team that the Texans are kind of on the same trajectory as you would hope, it's the Detroit Lions. You know, Dan Campbell was hired 2 years before D'Amico Ryans was. But the Lions defense is getting kind of a reputation. Brian Branch specifically. But the Lions are kind of getting a reputation as a team that, man, they're playing to the echo, the whistle. They're tough. They're physical. And I think by and large, defenses like that are embraced by more NFL fans than are denigrated.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be the heated, whichever particular offense is getting the brunt of it, those teams are going to feel like, ah, those guys are monsters over there, or that Texans defense or that Lions defense. By and large, people like that. I think most NFL fans are like, yeah, you want to believe you're tough, you know, and you're like, yeah, they're soft now.
Yeah.
A lot of that just comes down to, all right, but are you also good? Don't be a dirty team, or don't be a team that's like playing right up, pushing up against the envelope, but you're also not good. Be a good football team, and then you get the rubber stamp of approval from most people.
See how good this Texans football team turns out to be coming out of the bye week, week 14. They'll be put to the test this weekend. The Dolphins got the job done yesterday over the Jets, 32-26 in a victory there. This Dolphins game looks a hell of a lot different now, coming up this Sunday, Seth, than it did, you know, 6 weeks ago. And this is what it looked like preseason. You knew this was the start of a gauntlet where you had Miami, you had Kansas City, and you had the Ravens on Christmas Day, and this gauntlet of three games in 11 or 12 days, whatever it is, like, here we go. This is going to be This is going to be incredibly difficult. Is this team equipped to do this? Is this team talented enough and well coached enough to get through this gauntlet that you wouldn't maybe necessarily bat an eye at if it was the Chiefs doing it or the Ravens doing it or the Bengals doing it?
If we compare it to how I felt about it at the beginning of the season, mm-hmm. they're not nearly as equipped as I thought they would have been. The Dolphins game, first and foremost, you know, to tee off the festivities. Look, the Texans are favored in this game, and which I don't know if that's a surprise to people or not, but they're about a 2.5-point favorite, as it should be at home.
Home points, yeah.
Yeah, and they're a bit, like, the Dolphins are better with Tua, much, much better with Tua than they are without. But they're kind of average in a lot of regards. They look a lot like the Houston Texans. I think that the Dolphins game doesn't worry me anymore right now than it probably did at the beginning of the season, just because neither team is as good as the best possible version of it. So I feel good about that part of it. You get into the Chiefs and then the Ravens, and I mean, the Chiefs have played 15 consecutive one-score games.
Mm-hmm.
They keep winning them.
Yeah.
They have the lowest point differential ever for a 12-1 football team, or at least the lowest in many, many, many decades.
Wow.
That's the part where you look at it and you think, okay, well, the Chiefs play every team to just one possession. At the beginning of the season, I would have thought, okay, that's the Texans' dojo. They do really well in these one-score games. Now, not so much. I don't feel that same way. So I don't worry that the Texans are going to get bludgeoned by the Chiefs, but I have very, very little faith that if it comes down to the fourth quarter and one possession, that the Texans are going to be the first team that's able to undo the Chiefs, because they've just been too good in these situations.
Those are all great points. I think the Texans are good enough to where they could at least, you know, be in position to upset a Kansas City Chiefs team this year. Like, I've been thinking about this for weeks now. This is after last night's game, their win against the Chargers on a 31-yard field goal, doink, off of the left upright. This is their fourth game in their last five that has been decided by 3 points or fewer, and their fifth game in their last seven that has been decided by 6 points or fewer. All that the recency is the big one for me, because 15. I mean, that goes back to last year, and it's been a little bit. But
it goes back a long ways, and there's some luck involved in that too. If the Bills don't miss a field goal in the playoffs to tie it, what exactly happens? It's just it takes a little bit of luck to go on runs.
You're
like
right,
this.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a point that I was going to use to hammer this home. It's like, you have to look at history. Like, not all the time is it applicable, but for teams that are kind of like generationally great, like this Kansas City Chiefs team is under the Pat Mahomes and Andy Reid era, right? You look at the last 5 years alone and what this Chiefs team has done under both of those guys. Stretch run, the last month of the season, the Chiefs going back to 19 were 4-0, then 3-1, 3-1, 4-0 in 2022, 3-1 last year. And I'm looking at this team this year, the way that the Chiefs are playing and winning games, and I'm looking at the Texans. You know, they played the Lions close, and they've played in a lot of close games, and they've fallen short in some games against opponents you feel like they absolutely should have just kicked into teeth. But if this team is taking on a D'Amico Ryans personality and accepts this new role, and it's us versus the world, I feel like the Texans are as primed to beat the Chiefs at this point of the season as maybe they ever had been before. And what that could mean this time to the Texans is different than what it could have meant ever before.
Well, and just for those of you who haven't kept up with the division standings and whatnot, the Texans' magic number, to use the baseball phrasing, is 2. If they win 2 games, they're definitely in the playoffs and they win the division.
Mm-hmm.
The they have a tiebreaker over the Colts. So if the Texans win one game and the Colts lose one game, and the Colts play the Broncos this week in Denver, where finally they're underdogs. For a long time, the advanced line has had the Colts as favorites going into Denver, and I did not get it or understand it at all. Now they're 3 or 4 point underdogs out in Denver. But then the Colts have three easy games. I shouldn't say easy, but they face the Titans, they have the Jaguars, and they have the Giants, I believe. Mm-hmm. I don't know which order, but they've got three very winnable games after that. But realistically, you just have to win one game. So the Texans, if they don't win one of these next three games, I'm not even going to care about the playoffs. I'm just going to say, all right, well, if they can't win one of these next three games versus the Dolphins, the Chiefs, and then the Ravens, I'm going to feel like, all right, well, then I almost don't care if they're in. I almost don't want them in the playoffs because clearly they're not that team. Obviously, they're not going to be favorites in the Chiefs in the Ravens game. But winning one of these next three games versus respectable opponents, you've got to do one of those if you're a genuine bona fide playoff team.
I get what you're saying, but as with anything else, the context is important. I mean, if the Texans are in an absolute knockdown, drag-out type game here in a couple of weekends against the Kansas City Chiefs, and they lose, let's just say, to the Chiefs on a Harrison Butker 31-yard field goal doinker off the left upright, like the Chargers did last night, I'd feel at least encouraged, even after a loss to the Chiefs, that, you know what, you get into the postseason, like, all chips are on the table. Like, if they could beat us in the regular season like that, then damn it, with Kyahmi Fairbairn, who could boot a 59-yarder and against anybody, I'd feel just as good about the Texans' chances in upsetting somebody like that in the postseason. Because context is important. It's one thing if you're getting beat like the Ravens beat the Texans last year in the divisional round, like, that's just a flat-out better team, okay? Yeah. They beat you, but, you know, off of some doinkers or a late-inning, you know, drive, if it's Pat Mahomes, if it's Lamar Jackson, like, those guys are great quarterbacks for a reason, and if they beat you like that, then you kind of tip your cap and move on, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess the difference is, and this is the dangerous part, is that you can get into any situation and say, well, hey, look, it was they had a one-score game against the Lions. They had a one-score game against the Packers. But it happens over and over and over again. And by the way, you lost to the Jets. You lost to the Titans. you did in a very embarrassing and second-half dismantling type of fashion that – I think that's who they are. You can't talk about the what have been, you know, what might have been's when you're consistently doing it over and over again. And that's where I need at some point over these next four games to see that they are a different team now. That they're one of these teams that can make a push and have figured some things out and can surge at the end of the season to feel like you're not going to have a replay of that Ravens game from last year.
Look, I think you and Sean are probably going to be able to have a really good discussion on this matter this week when Pendergast comes back tomorrow. But I am interested in a tweet that you had last Friday where you asked the question, the Texans are 2 years behind Detroit in terms of when the head coach was hired. What do they need to do in the next 2 years to get on the Lions level? That's a really in-depth, I think, fascinating conversation to have. But I'm going to ask you point blank, like, what can the Texans do over the course of the next couple of months to do what has been so intriguing about the Lions and what they've done the last 2 years, where they've been able to not just have a seat at the table with some of these marquee opponents like the Chiefs or the Ravens or the Niners, whoever it is in the NFL, and not just be competitive, but to beat their ass and to do so with some, you know, big time stones like Dan Campbell has and his team's taking on, you know, that kind of personality. Can the Texans accomplish some iteration of that over the course of the next month plus?
We'll do that next.
That's the question. 713-572-4610 if you'd like to weigh in. 572-4610. You can hit us up on the 5-Hour Energy Fan Line. What you think. We'll get to that and what the latest deals in baseball over the course of the last 24 hours means to the Houston Astros and the Alex Bregman situation. Stay there.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani, along with Seth Payne this morning. Got you till 8 o'clock before we turn things over to Texans Radio. Make sure you keep it here on Sports Radio 610 all day, 10 until 2. The guys in the loop will be back in house today. Reggie Atitula, John Lopez, looking forward to that. Between now and then, Seth, I ask you the question, and I know you guys will have this discussion at some point this week between you and Sean Pendergast, but you know, how far behind the Lions are the Texans? That was a question you asked after the show on Friday. And just, I'm kind of curious if you think the Texans can at least tap into some of that over the course of the next, month plus and make a run.
I think the biggest thing is, and I realized after I'd asked that, okay, I could have just asked, all right, what do the Texans have to do to beat the Lions when they intercept Jared Goff five times? Because that's probably the sum total of everything. The Texans defense it's not a record-breaking defense or anything else like that. It's certainly capable, though, of being, you could take that defense and plop it down on multiple other teams in the league and say, oh yeah, you could win a Super Bowl with that defense. The offense is decidedly not that same thing. So really, okay, how do you win a game where you intercept the quarterback five times? How do you win two games this season where you're plus three in the turnover margin? When you look at the Lions, I think quarterback, I'm just 100% fine with C.J. Stroud. I feel better about his next 10 years over Jared Goff's next 10 years. It's hard not to just dial in on the offensive line. And then it's also hard not to notice, man, the Lions have not just one but two running backs that you get really nervous about. And then the way that the offensive coordinator ties it all together, I think those are the areas right now that are the most glaringly obvious. Okay, the offensive coordinator, the offensive line, and then the depth at running back is just night and day different than where the Texans are right now.
Yeah, boy, you're talking about offense tying everything together, and particularly Ben Johnson, the offensive coordinator. You could ask a very similar question, like, how far behind Bobby Slowick? How far behind is Bobby Slowick from Ben Johnson in his offensive innovation and what he's gotten his guys, the ability to do with some terrific skill players in Detroit, like the Texans have now acquired here in Houston, some terrific skill players. Maybe not, we'll never see the full iteration of what Bobby Slowick thought he was going to have at his disposal, but he got some pretty good weapons still here.
Yeah, he has the weaponry. Like, that's why there was so much optimism around the league. It wasn't just Houston bias or anything about what this Texans offense could do. And for the most part, the relatively impartial observers of quarterback play are still very impressed with the stuff that C.J. Stroud is able to do under imperfect circumstances. I think the tale with Brian Johnson can't be told without remembering that, oh yeah, he was a mid-season change in 2021. That the turnaround for the Lions really started when they demoted the play caller and made Brian Johnson the play caller. And then in the offseason going into 2022, he was named the offensive coordinator. That's what we were looking at earlier in the season as, hey, maybe there's a guy on staff that they feel as good about as Brian Johnson. And I mean, I was still, right up until all the Azeez Alshire hubbub, that was my biggest question going into the bye week was, okay, is there anybody on staff right now that they feel really good about? And would D'Amico actually pull the trigger at this point in the season when it's really your last chance? And all of that kind of fell by the wayside, partly because of the Azeez Alshire stuff, partly because the Texans scored two second-half touchdowns versus one of the worst defenses in the league. But then also, I think it was also a matter of Nick Caserio just adamantly the other day saying flat out, no, there will be no change, or that they have faith in Bobby Slowick and they're not making a change. Like, it felt like he slammed the door shut on any speculation.
Real quick, because I do want to get to some baseball stuff here, but I'm always intrigued by, making changes as offensive coordinator or play caller at this stage of the season. We know teams do it, right? And we know there's been success, for teams that have done it. But
the Bills last year.
Yes, absolutely. But my question is always, okay, if you're going to make a change, that means the person that you're going to turn the reins over to that's in-house has different ideas, has better ideas, has things, you know, up under up their sleeve that, you know, you believe in that we should have been getting to as a football team. That's why you make a change, right? And that for whoever's in charge right now, in case of Bobby Slowik, just has been unwilling or not confident enough to do that. Well, when you don't make a change, does that signal like, you know, that, hey, maybe Gerard Johnson or Bill Lazor or whoever, like, they're all simpatico. Like, nobody really has any original ideas, or nobody else can really do anything that, you know, is going to get the best out of this group or optimize this group like Bobby Slowik could.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Lazor's the guy on staff who has previous offensive coordinating experience, and none of it has been such of the variety that you know for sure, okay, like, this is a guy that can just, it's not like you've got a late stage Norv Turner or something where you know he can come in and do something. Mm-hmm. It's not as much of a slam dunk. He was always in Lazor's when he's had his chances. It's been in imperfect circumstances in Cincinnati or in Miami. But I think there's, and then I think with Gerard Johnson, a couple of listeners brought this up when we first started discussing Gerard Johnson. I think there's a hesitancy to take a guy who hasn't been an NFL assistant coach that long and who hasn't been a coordinator before to replace a guy that you're realizing he was also a first-time offensive coordinator. So you're going to go through the same growing pains. Ben Johnson had been like a non-quality control guy, like full-time assistant coach since 2013, I think. So like, he's got a couple of years a head start on Bobby Slowik. So I get that part of it. I think, like, in some regards, it's almost like I don't want to bring this team up, but, you know, the Giants and the bump that they got that first year with Brian Daboll.
Yeah.
It was almost too much of a turnaround too soon, and it maybe obfuscated just how real all of the other challenges were. Mm-hmm. And you end up like being ramped up on your rebuild process faster than the public perception was that you're going to be. I think that, and I'm going to have to be okay with this. I think that Caserio and D'Amico probably look at it as, hey, you've got a young coordinator. These are the growing pains you're going to have, but we believe in him moving on into the future. It's just the fan base and myself are not going to buy into that until we actually see evidence of it on the field.
Well, you talk about buying into things. To get to this here, just the last few minutes of today's show, the Mets have bought into a lot of Juan Soto. They give him the richest deal in pro sports history last night. 15-year pact, $765 million, could be worth up to $800 million with escalators, no deferred money, according to reports, all that stuff. That's the biggest domino that possibly could have fallen, Seth. And I bring that up because prior to that, in fact, I think it was a day or two before, might have just been after we got off the show on Friday, but Willy Adames signed a deal with the San Francisco Giants. 7 years, $182 million. That's the biggest contract in Giants history. Bigger than Buster Posey's. But that's a big deal because reportedly that was one of the guys that maybe the Astros were looking at and that the Yankees were looking at. If, in fact, from the Astros' perspective, Alex Bregman was going to be deemed unsignable because of what he wants, that's a big deal. If the Astros are not willing to go, you know, 6+ years on Alex Bregman, probably not in the conversation really with Willy Adames. But the point is contingencies and plan Bs for the Astros are running short if, in fact, they don't make a decision on Alex Bregman. I think just by what we've learned over the course of the last 24, 48 hours, there's probably a decision or some finality, let's just say this, with Bregman at least, over the course of the next week, week and a half, that we should be looking out for.
The next week, you think?
I think so. I really do.
I've come to just be skeptical of any kind of like actual hot stove action in Major League Baseball free agency anymore.
Well, the reason why I say that is, look, you got the big domino that fell last night with Juan Soto. Now the attention turns, like, everybody's worried about, okay, is this guy going to be a $600 million player? Hell, he's almost an $800 million player now. Attention now turns to your, you know, tier two guys, let's so to speak. If Juan Soto was sitting by itself in tier one, now you look at, you know, your Alex Bregman types and what kind of deals are they going to be commanding and how much did the overall market change with his contract, and if it has anything to do with, if one has anything to do with the other. I think players and teams really kind of want to have some finality before Christmas, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know. I also know Bregman's personality, and I feel like he's just so calm. I don't think there's any part of Bregman that's like agitating or calling Scott Boris and
not
saying,
now.
You gotta get this deal done now, damn it. He's just off in the batting cage somewhere with his son, just working on stuff, and Boris will handle it whenever he handles it. I guess the one thing about Adamas that if you want to look on the optimistic side of it is it's the average per year is about the same. It's just one extra year. And we know that's the big part that the Astros get hung up on, and we might never, they're not going to stretch that far.
Yeah. Hey, man, a lot of fun this morning. We'll talk to you again soon. Pendergast will be back tomorrow. Make sure you keep it locked in here. Coming up next, it's Texans Radio on Sports Radio 610.